I'm Peter Huapi, editor and producer for Looking for the Tote Family. And over the course of 10 episodes, we've had a lot of unanswered questions, and it turns out that a lot of you, our listeners, have had a lot of questions about this story as well. So today, I'm sitting down with our co-hosts, Sten Spinella and Taylor Hartz, to try to answer some of the questions from our audience. Hello, Sten. Hello, Taylor. How are you guys today?
Hey. How you doing? I'm good.
I'm good.
It's been quite the long process getting this podcast out. How's it feel now that we've finished a first season?
I felt liberated, to be quite honest. I guess a little surprised. I never thought that we would actually get the full season out there. There were times when we were a year into it and still hadn't released an episode that I was despairing. So I guess proud, surprised, and definitely liberated, even though we're not quite done. I can go back to my writing job.
I feel really excited to have the whole first season out there. And I'm also really proud of the work that we've done. I think we uncovered a lot more than I expected to over the course of 10 episodes. And I'm really happy with the final product that we put together. I'm anxious to get to the trial and continue covering this case. And I'm also really grateful to all of our listeners. I think this has reached a wider audience than we ever could have anticipated. And we're really thankful that so many people are tuning in and following this case and coming along with us as we try to figure out what happened to this family.
You guys are primarily newspaper reporters writing stories for The Day, which is a small local newspaper here in southeastern Connecticut. When this story first came up, why did it occur to you guys to tell this as a podcast rather than just a series of news stories?
Well, I will first of all say that Taylor was definitely the first person to speak the idea of a podcast into existence, but I was thinking about it before she said it. I know that sounds like a cop-out, but I was, and I think I just had no idea how one would even go about making a podcast, and Taylor was kind of like, I don't care, like, we need to do this. And so the reason that I think it was a good idea is because, for one, there's so many levels to this story, so many layers, that it's kind of hard to do it justice with just a new story every time a piece of information comes out, where three or four paragraphs of that story are background info that we've had in previous stories. This was a better way to tell it in terms of form. Also, I think we felt closer to it than other media outlets that covered it very closely, like the Orlando Sentinel or the Hartford Courant, because it's in our backyard. One of our sports staff, who's been here for years, still has a letter from Tony that Tony wrote to him when he was captain of the Montville soccer team. So we just felt like we were closer to this and it deserved to be told in this kind of sequential way by a podcast.
Within a couple of days of covering the tote case, it really struck me that this was one of the most horrific murders I had ever heard of. And to have something that horrible and as gruesome as these murders happen in a small town in Connecticut, and to affect two communities so closely, and to have those crimes happen to three innocent children and a dog, just really tugged at my heart and made me think that this family deserved to have their story told beyond just the national headlines. This was a story that really got people's attention all across the country. I think even internationally, there were headlines in People magazine and on major TV news networks. And unfortunately, there's so much news and there are so many murders that take place in the U.S. on a regular basis. A lot of times, you know, these stories are mentioned in the headlines and then people move on and people forget about what happened. I felt like there needed to be a publication that dedicated the time to finding out what happened to them and finding out how and why something this horrible happened. And I thought we could do it.
All right. So we received a lot of questions from our audience, and I guess we'll do our best to get to as many as we can. But I think it bears mentioning before we dive into that, that there are a lot of questions that we just don't have answers to. And so we'll do our best to address some of those and maybe shed whatever light we can. But apologies in advance that there will be some questions where the answer is just that we honestly don't know at this point. So let's start with a question that came in from Rebecca.
Has anyone else in the Tote's life ever talked about Megan's theories around the world ending? Or is it just what we've heard from Tony's sister?
Unfortunately, the only thing we know about Megan's potential beliefs in an end of the world or an apocalyptic theory are what you guys hear in the podcast. Chrissy mentioning it to dispatchers when she's calling police for a wellness check. We don't know whether that message was sent in a text message. We don't know whether it was something that was said over the phone. Throughout the course of our investigation, we haven't been able to talk to Tony's sisters, and we haven't been able to talk to many of Megan's friends that she had in Celebration, the people that were closest to her in the last few years of her life. So we have not heard from anyone that this is something that she believed in, something that she followed, something that she practiced or would have acted on. The closest people to Megan that we've spoken to are her aunt and uncle, Cindy and Stuart. And they did not ever mention anything to us about Megan having any type of paranoia or beliefs in any type of Mayan calendar or apocalypse fears that would lead her to say something about the world ending. I did ask her uncle, Stu, at one point if he had any idea about whether these claims that Tony makes in his letter that Megan did this because she was fearful of the end of the world, and he did not have any knowledge of Megan believing in that sort of thing.
I think that the question is a good question because we don't know for sure whether this is something Megan believed or whether it's Tony taking something and blowing it up and basically making it the motive for her committing the murders. You know, it's possible that it's Tony either completely fabricating or taking something small and blowing it out of proportion, or that he's telling the truth, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah, unfortunately, the people that were really closest to Megan in the last few years were her sisters-in-law and some friends that she had in Celebration. And I think, you know, a group of friends that she had here from college or from high school. We spoke to some of her friends that were good friends from childhood who stayed in touch with her over social media. And we did ask them if they ever saw her posting anything about the end of the world on her social media accounts. And they never did.
Two people we very much want to talk to, or at least one group of people that we think could answer this question, would be Megan's friends in Celebration, who, like Taylor said, declined to talk to us, and Chrissy, who we still very much like to interview.
I think this subject matter, in a vacuum of information, there are these little tidbits that people out in the world following this story like to kind of grab onto and try to like dive into and research. Like someone wrote in and said that they heard about this and were trying to research, was this a Mayan prophecy? Was this something biblical? And if you want to go down the rabbit hole online, I spent 5 minutes and was able to find references to Mayan prophecies predicting the end times in 2003, 2012, 2017, 2019, and 2020. So there's all kinds of stuff out there, but without talking to the people who are closest to the story, it's not something that we as journalists can really speak to without speculating.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, when we talked about the theories, when we addressed the theories in the last episode, we tried to make it so that was really the only amount of time we spent on the theories throughout the series. But I will say the end of the world comment intrigued us too, and that's why it came up multiple times. The fact that Chrissy mentioned it definitely added some weight to it. And definitely don't blame you for doing your own research, because we've all done the same Google searches about the end of the world since we learned about that.
Yeah, I think as a host of this show, it was really interesting to see that come up so often and the questions that you all send in, because, you know, we don't know what's standing out to you as listeners the most in this case. And it seemed like this comment about the end of the world was really something that stuck out to a lot of people. And we've had the same experience. I think, you know, this case has been a big part of Sten and I's lives for the past year. And we theorize and we try to figure out if we think we know what happened. And every time I think I have a conversation with Sten or I have a conversation with one of my friends or family members, everyone always likes to ask me, do you know who did it? Do you know what happened? And anytime I come close to having a concrete theory, I always find myself coming back to saying, oh, but then there's the end of the world comment. It's like something that just stands out and doesn't fit with the rest of the narrative that we have. It doesn't fit with everything that everyone's told us about Megan. And like Sten said, I think that's why we really wish that we could talk to people who were friends with Megan as an adult. We were hoping to speak to some other moms in celebration that she was friends with when we went down to Florida, but they changed their mind at the last minute. And we've been hoping to speak with Tony's sisters throughout this investigation. And we still hope to. We still make efforts to give those people that knew Megan in the last years of her life an opportunity to talk so that they can tell us whether this was something that she was involved in or believed in. We do know that Megan was very into homeopathic medicine and all natural foods, and that she practiced yoga pretty frequently. So that's something that kind of lines up pretty well with Tony's claims that she had gotten into her, you know, spirituality and meditating a bit more. But there's a huge leap between someone using herbal remedies with their family and cooking organic food and practicing yoga and believing in end of the world prophecies that come to them through meditation. So we don't know.
Question from Ellen. Was there any evidence of a holiday celebration in their house? A tree, wrapping paper, new toys, etc.? And did anybody receive holiday cards or gifts from them?
We don't know if the totes sent out holiday cards that year. And we don't know if they sent gifts back to their family. But we did hear about them giving one Christmas gift to the kid's music teacher. They attended a holiday concert on December 14th in Florida, which was the last time that the family was seen alive. And they gave their music teacher, Bobby Sedgwick, a Christmas gift of artisanal soaps. But there was no evidence in the home of the family celebrating Christmas. There was no Christmas tree. There were no empty boxes or piles of wrapping paper. There weren't any Christmas decorations on the exterior of the home or inside, which from what we heard was pretty unusual for the totes and pretty unusual for most homes in celebration. It's a town where people seem to decorate their homes for every occasion and every season. So that was something that I think came up pretty early on in the case that was a little odd and concerning, that it didn't seem like they celebrated Christmas that year or planned to celebrate it. We do know that some family members sent gifts down to Florida for the kids, and that Megan's aunt had reached out asking if the kids opened their presents, and I think asked to, you know, talk to them on the phone or video chat with them on Christmas morning. And that was when I believe Cindy first started hearing those claims that the family was sick and, you know, they couldn't talk on the phone. They couldn't video chat to show them opening their presents because they weren't feeling well.
Okay, next question is from Mary. Mary says, Tony had claimed that he did all the cooking when he went to see Megan and the children. So who made the alleged Benadryl pie?
This question, I mean, it's a good observation. And it's an inconsistency we didn't point out. Tony was saying that he would prepare meals for the kids to have during the week when he had to go back to Connecticut to work. But he says on the day that on the day of the family's deaths, that Megan was looking up recipes and that she was cooking that day and in the kitchen. So he makes the day sound like an exception to the rule. He says that she was up and she could do physical therapy. She was feeling good. So it's possible that he was setting the stage for a couple things that were out of the ordinary, like her baking.
So Tony claims that Megan made the pie while he was out at the condo and asleep, and that he came back and the remnants of it were on the kitchen table. He says that it looked like one of the beautiful baked goods his wife was always making, but that it smelled terrible. And then he goes on to say in his letter to his father, his actual words are, "It turns out it was a Benadryl pudding pie." And he says that there was Benadryl and Tylenol PM in the pie. So this is something that Sten's right, we didn't bring up when we were talking about the inconsistencies, but it's something that I've thought about and my mom was actually asking me about this week. She was saying that she kept thinking about the pie and she had all these questions. And some of the things that we were discussing or some questions that we can ask are, how did he know that there was Benadryl and Tylenol PM in the pie if he wasn't there when it was made and he supposedly came home and found the remnants of it? That's a very specific claim to make. You know, he could have said that the pie was laced with something or that the pie was drugged, but he was very specific about what was in it. And another thing that I've thought about more is, if he's saying that, you know, he walked into the house and immediately he could smell how terrible this pie smelled, how do you get a 4-year-old to eat a pie that smells and tastes like medicine, and an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old? Also, we received a lot of photos of the crime scene from the state's attorney's office. They sent us multiple folders filled with photos of most of the house and the condo. There are photos of knives. There are photos of empty Benadryl packets, but there are no photos of a pie or the remnants of a pie. And in the crime scene reports that we have now, there has never been any mention of a pie being found at the scene, and the bodies were significantly decomposed by the time that they were found. So I don't know if a medical examiner would have been able to, you know, determine what they had eaten prior to their deaths, but there haven't been any reports from law enforcement officials or the medical examiner that have said anything about a pie being ingested by the family or being found in the house.
Another listener wanted to know if we know that the killings took place inside that same house at 202 Reserve Place. I think the insinuation is, could they have been killed elsewhere?
I think technically, yes, they could have been killed elsewhere, but law enforcement has never indicated that they were killed elsewhere. And I should also say that even in Tony's multiple versions of this story, the consistent thing has always been that the murders happened at the house, which I think you could put a little more stock into, because we've pointed out all the times, at least as many times as we could, of his stories either not matching up or, you know, inconsistencies. That was consistent. That's probably worth something.
Dana asks, do we know if Tony had any kind of internet footprint during the missing days and weeks? Do we know if he used his home PC or his phone, for example?
We don't know. Law enforcement has been pretty tight-lipped since their initial press conference in this case, and information about his whereabouts, his movements, his cell phone and internet usage is probably going to continue to be tightly sealed until the case goes to trial. I would expect information about that to come out in the trial. The only thing we do have that is pretty interesting and is something that we haven't really been able to figure out the story behind is that Tony's phone was found by a stranger at a Starbucks in Sarasota, Florida, a little over 2 hours away from the house in Celebration, during the time period that he was allegedly living in the house with the dead bodies. The last text message that was sent from Tony's phone to one of his sisters was on January 6th. And then later that day, there was a text that came from Tony's phone, but was from someone else saying that they'd found the phone at a Starbucks. We don't know how it got there. We don't know if Tony brought it there, if he left it there on purpose, if he lost it. But that's something that I'm, again, sure will come out in the trial.
And the crime scene photos include pictures of a couple different devices, phones and computers. So you could probably assume that if there was some sort of internet history, the police would have access to that.
Yeah, great point. And even though it was before, well before the fact, the FBI did raid his offices in Colchester in November. And it's possible that at least in terms of the fraud case against him, which is temporarily suspended, that they were able to find information that way.
And since you bring that up, I think it might be a good time to address another question that came in from a listener named Lisa, who asked if there was any evidence of Megan being in charge of the family's financial accounts, which is something that Tony says mostly when he's discussing the fraud that he's accused of. He says that he didn't know anything about any healthcare fraud because Megan was in charge of all of their finances, both personal and with the businesses. The answer is no, we don't have any evidence that points to Megan handling their finances, other than the fact that the FBI did raid Tony's businesses and conduct a thorough investigation into this healthcare fraud scandal, and they arrested Tony. Not Megan.
Tony took full responsibility and said that Megan had nothing to do with the finances at the time. And we should say that in talking to friends and in talking to Randy Gallagher, Tony's former employee at Family Physical Therapy, she at least highly doubted the idea that Megan was the mastermind behind the finances and the fraud scheme. She saw Tony much more on a daily basis, and he was in the office all the time. But Tony does put the fraud at Megan's feet, just like he puts the murders there.
So Lisa also asked if we've been able to get any information about Megan's health and activities and her ability to function from anybody besides Tony.
So according to the medical examiner, Megan had been diagnosed with Lyme disease. So that is confirmed. And we do know that Lyme disease can really be debilitating, and that moving to a warmer climate may have helped her feel better. But everyone we've spoken to has denied Tony's claims that Megan was severely ill or unable to function normally. Her friends that we've spoken to and members of their family and people that followed her on social media that were old friends,
neighbors,
people that saw her out and about in the neighborhood, people that had children that played with the Totes children, all said that Megan always seemed perfectly fine. She was always cooking and teaching. She homeschooled the kids, so she was doing that full time. She practiced yoga. She cooked everything from scratch. She baked. She brought the kids to their music lessons, and she was a musician herself and helped the boys learn piano, and they were also learning guitar and violin. They had lessons and recitals, and Zoe was about to start dance classes, and Megan, from what they saw, handled all of that and loved doing it.
Yeah, I mean, and also think about this. She had a yoga group. Like you said, she did yoga. She had a yoga group that we weren't able to talk to people in, but if she's regularly doing yoga, I think the people who are doing it with her could attest to her being okay.
Michelle writes, "The question I kept asking while listening was why hasn't or didn't anyone ask him why he didn't call the police when he came home and saw his family dead, especially after his wife killed herself? Why then did he not call the police? Why did he continue to live with the dead bodies for at least 2 weeks?"
I mean, I have the same question. Why didn't you contact the authorities or the neighbors if your kids were brutalized like that and your wife was killing herself? And we, of course, don't know why or if this even happened the way Tony said it did, where he was in a position to call the police, but in his telling, he was. And his reasoning in general was that he wanted to respect Megan's wishes. And that he says in the letter, "I know it was irrational." So he's recognizing that that's not really a great reason for not going to the authorities or alerting neighbors. But he said he was being irrational.
So I said at the beginning of this episode that one of the reasons that I suggested we make a podcast about this case is because it's one of the most horrific cases I've ever heard of. And I think this is the part that makes it so horrific. When we learned, I can remember exactly where we were sitting when we heard for the first time that he had been living in that house with their dead bodies for 2 weeks. And I remember walking through the hall of our newsroom and stopping at my editor's desk and saying he was living with the bodies for weeks because I just could not wrap my head around it. And I still can't. And I think that I have had the opportunity to talk to Tony, but I haven't had the chance to ask him specific questions about this case. And as soon as I'm able to do that, if I ever am, that will be my first question. As Sten said, Tony claims in the letter that Megan asked him to stay with her as she was dying and not to call anyone. And he claims that Megan had hidden their phones. So that would presumably mean that he didn't have the means to call the police. He didn't have access to a phone. But we know from the medical examiner that the family was dead for at least 2 weeks by the time they were found on January 13th. And we know that text messages were being sent from Tony's phone up until January 6th, and that his phone was then found in Sarasota. So assuming that a stranger didn't come to his house and steal his phone and drive it to Sarasota, Tony was using his phone. He was sending messages to people up until after Christmas. Megan's aunt and uncle were receiving text messages from her. There were messages coming from the oldest son. Tony was communicating with the outside world, and he therefore did have the opportunity to report these deaths to the authorities. And if we go by what he says in the letter about going out to buy a Polish dish called galumpkis and some cheese and more Benadryl, then we know that Tony was also, you know, he left the house. He went to a store, and he allegedly apparently drove all the way to Sarasota to go to a Starbucks, either to plant his phone or to get a coffee. So he had opportunities, from what we know, to get help and to tell someone what happened. And if his claims are true, he was under severe emotional duress. He had been consuming a ton of Benadryl and attempting suicide repeatedly. He'd suffered trauma and he was experiencing memory loss. So, you know, if his account of what happened is true, then it's possible that, and likely that, he wasn't thinking clearly. He wasn't thinking or behaving rationally. But we do know that, you know, he was sending pretty coherent texts to his family members about their travel plans to go to St. Augustine, about their the flu that they were battling, about the holidays, and never once mentioned that everyone else in the family was dead.
We talked a lot about in the later episodes of the podcast, Tony having an answer for everything. And that is just something he did not address in the letter and had no real answer for, is why he stayed in the house with the bodies for so long. He didn't even bring it up, kind of like Breezy. So it seems like there are some spots, some aspects of this that even in the 27-page letter, Tony didn't want to touch.
One of our listeners sent in a question asking why we didn't address the possibility that Tony was being controlled or emotionally or mentally abused by Megan. And, you know, this is a part where that possibility might come in. If he was being emotionally manipulated at length by his wife, and she told him not to tell anyone, not to call police, to stay with her, then it's possible that that years of abuse, or whatever length of time that he was being abused and controlled, combined with the trauma of losing his family, could have led to him just behaving irrationally and not making a decision to report this to the police. Maybe, you know, whether or not he did it or Megan did it, he didn't want to face the reality of it. And that's what calling the police would have meant. He moved his whole family into one bedroom so that after they were dead so that they could all be together. And it's possible that he just didn't want that to end, which he knew would happen if he reported the deaths to police. But to address that listener's question, we never talked about the possibility that Tony was being abused by Megan because we have no evidence of that. We only have a picture of them as a happy family and a happy couple, and we have not heard from anyone else in their lives that Megan was ever controlling or abusive or suffering from any type of mental illness, or that Tony was the victim of any domestic abuse.
A lot of our listeners have really strong opinions over who is responsible for this crime and have had a lot of strong reactions to what they perceive is how you feel about who may or may not be responsible. So a few people asked why you two are so resistant to the idea that Megan may have been responsible. Someone else wrote, quote, "I must admit towards the end, it felt like you were more sympathetic towards Tony's story." So how do you guys respond to that?
I think we've had people say, like, you just came up with these two examples, and not just in questions submitted to us. People have said that we lean too heavily one side or the other, which is something we've talked about. We didn't want to pick a side. That's not our job. Our job is to just lay out what we know, and hopefully you want to listen to it. But I would say that we tried to tell the story fairly, always thinking about that. A little concerned in later episodes, the possibility of giving Tony a platform to proclaim his innocence, kind of like Robert. And I think in both situations, we made it very clear that this was coming only from Tony or Robert, or at least in the Robert episode, we made the conscious decision to cut out a lot of what Robert Tote was saying about his case in the 80s. It wasn't germane to this, and I think it's probably a good thing that we have people saying that are on both sides of this. It probably means that we did the job at least the way we wanted to, whether or not you think we're with Megan or with Tony. Obviously, we have our suspicions. We're human, but we would never come out and pick a side, because you can't proclaim innocence before guilty, and also just basic day one journalism stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's we're both glad to hear that there are questions and criticisms in our comments of people saying both that we lean too heavily toward Tony's guilt or too heavily toward Megan's guilt, or too sympathetic toward Tony or too sympathetic toward Megan, because quite frankly, that means that we've done our job. I mean, I can say personally that, like, I don't know. I really genuinely don't know what happened in that house.
Richard asks, was it necessary to include the idea that Robert Tote and Tony Tote were psychopaths? And he goes on to point out that there's a lot of harmful stereotypes surrounding mental illness, and that there's plenty of people with mental illnesses who are not murderers. And he also takes issue with you guys using the word monster to describe Tony.
I think we appreciate this question, and we think it's a good dialogue to open up. I think it's important to clarify that we at no point call Robert or Tony a sociopath, a psychopath, or a monster. We were very careful about the language that we used when discussing these possibilities. And we do want to clarify that we say that, you know, Tony is perceived as a monster, or it's possible that Robert and Tony are sociopaths and that they don't have empathy for the victims in the cases that have been brought against them. But we were very careful about our language there. And as reporters, it's not our place to label anyone with a mental illness or a diagnosis, or especially to call them a monster. That's not something that we would do, because it's not our place to have that opinion on people whose cases we're covering. And we're not mental health professionals. We don't have the ability to diagnose anyone with a mental illness.
None of this was us bringing in the idea of him being a sociopath or a psychopath. It was from outside sources. So it was Judge Rubenstein, the former assistant district attorney who helped put Robert Tote in jail. It was the Hartford Courant, and it was a prevalent question. I mean, you even heard the media at his perp walk asking him if he had any remorse. But as Taylor's about to talk about, that we had so many conversations about even using the Hartford Courant part and referencing the Courant and talking about this story they did where they spoke with a mental health professional about Robert and Tony. And we also had conversations about how we were going to use the judge's quote about that, because we know that it's a sensitive subject and we don't want to go out on a limb and implicate people without.
Well, but Robert brought it up.
That's true. That's
Robert
true.
Brought up those Hartford Courant articles. So I thought that it was appropriate for you guys to give that comment some context.
That's a good point. Robert brought it up as well and complained about the Hartford Courant, like Tony's complained about the media many, many times, insinuating that he may be a psychopath or a sociopath.
We had a lot of conversations about whether or not we wanted to bring a mental health expert onto this podcast to talk about what it would mean for someone to be what's called a family annihilator, which if Tony is convicted, he would be considered. There have been, you know, several cases tried in the U.S. and covered in the media in the past couple years in which a father and husband is convicted or charged with killing his family. We thought about bringing an expert to talk about, you know, what leads often a man to kill his wife and children. We also discussed talking to a mental health expert who could speak to us about the effect that childhood trauma, like what Tony experienced in the shooting of his mother and the conviction of his father, could lead to in an adult. Could it lead someone to commit a similar crime with their own family in the future? But at the end of the day, we decided that those interviews wouldn't be appropriate because any mental health expert we spoke to would really just be theorizing. They don't know Tony. They haven't spoken to him. They don't know how he was impacted by that childhood trauma.
It also felt to me that that conversation was premature because he hasn't even been convicted of it.
So
that conversation right now basically assumes his guilt.
One of the first people we reached out to when we were thinking about a podcast was an expert on family annihilators. And we, something fell through. Sometimes interviews don't work out. And we basically just found reporting that was more important at that time. When we came back to the idea, like Peter said, we realized that interviewing somebody about this would insinuate guilt or could even, you know, end up in exonerating the person you're talking about. If the expert you're talking to says this person exhibits no signs of being this thing, it couldn't be them. Or they say, yeah, this is a classic sociopath. Of course, they killed the family. So like Taylor said, I think it would make more sense to talk to someone like this after the trial. I think innocent or guilty, I think it would be interesting because he'll be in the public eye. I think it would be and a lot of the details about the case are going to come out. It'd definitely be more fair to speculate at that point than a month after things happened, in my opinion.
I agree. I think that, you know, once the trial is maybe not even concluded, but just underway, that it would be more appropriate for us to bring in a behavioral analysis or a psychologist or any type of mental health expert to speak about Tony's potential behavior. And I think that it would also be a good idea for us to talk to somebody that's an expert on family annihilators if Tony is convicted of being that. I think that we also may have been more inclined to bring someone on to talk about family annihilators if we had access to Tony's confession. You know, police have told us that Tony confessed, and if I had a document in front of me that showed Tony's word-for-word confession that he said he killed his family, then I would have been eager to bring an expert on family annihilators into this podcast. I think, you know, if any of you are true crime fans and have watched the Netflix documentary American Murderer about the Chris Watts case, there has been a lot of discussion surrounding that case and family annihilators. And a lot of people have compared Tony Tote to Chris Watts in the comments on social media about our podcast, or have said that this case and what they've heard in the podcast has reminded them of that documentary. And I think that's why I bring up the fact that we don't have that confession, because that's a big distinction. You know, Chris Watts is on video that's been released to the media and therefore the public through Netflix confessing to killing his wife and kids. We don't have that from Tony. We actually have the opposite. We have him claiming his innocence. And until we can see that confession, which I'm assuming and hoping that we'll be able to see very early on in the trial, we don't want to put that label on him, because that's not our job.
Two more questions about your guys' approach as journalists. Amy asks, how do you separate yourselves from the details of the story? And brings up the examples of Taylor having Tony call you at 9 o'clock at night out of the blue, or having to go and knock on the door of Robert Tote, somebody who's been convicted. He maintains his innocence, but someone who's been convicted of hiring someone to attempt to kill someone.
I definitely think we both were desensitized a little bit to violence and that sort of thing during this. There were times where I felt like, was I just like a cold person because I maybe wasn't as moved emotionally as Taylor was in certain situations. But then there would be times like some of the conversations we had where it would all just come, the how screwed up this whole thing would all come rushing at me at once.
Especially when we first started covering it and reporting for the podcast about a year ago, there were a few Facebook groups that were very active and I had notifications turned on for them. So it didn't matter if I was had my first day off in months, I was at the beach, I was trying to relax. If there was some type of break or update in this case, I would drop anything to cover it and send it as well. You know, we haven't really gotten like a full day off in a very long time. But I think we both recognize that it's such important work, and it really is such a heartbreaking case that's affected so many people. So we're willing to put in the work for it, but we could both be better at, especially me, you know, turning it off sometimes and not thinking about this case. Emotionally, I feel like it's difficult. There's a balance between letting it affect you and not letting the emotions in at all. I'm a very emotional person. I'm super sensitive. But since I became a breaking news reporter, the first breaking news event I covered in college was the Boston Marathon bombings. And I have always been very good at compartmentalizing and recognizing that I'm on the job, that I'm doing a public service by relaying information to people that are wondering what's going on or are trying to understand a tragedy that has rocked the community or the city that they live in. And I'm usually very good at not being emotional while I'm actually working, while I'm covering something. But then there's always, you know, the moment when I finally get home at the end of the day after, you know, covering a breaking news story in my regular job or being in this studio all day talking about crime scene photos and autopsy reports and looking at those images and describing them for you guys, that I get home and I finally have a minute to sit down and unwind and let those emotions come through. And it's hard. You know, sometimes it would really get to me. Sometimes I wouldn't be able to sleep. I would have nightmares. I would wake up in the middle of the night. There were times that I started crying in this studio explaining something about one of the kids' lives or talking about how they were killed. And I think everyone that has, you know, actually been in this studio recording this podcast or editing it has had a moment where they've gotten choked up or have, in my case, actually started crying, because it's heartbreaking. These are real people. These are real children and a dog that were killed for no reason. And there are a lot of people that miss them and are confused and are heartbroken, and we are trying to find answers for them, and we're trying to tell their stories. So there have been a lot of emotional conversations, and it hasn't been easy. The listener asked specifically about the day that we interviewed Robert and the night that Tony called me. And I think another really, you know, pivotal moment is the day that we got to Celebration and we went to the house where they were killed. I think knocking on Robert's door and getting the phone call from Tony were definitely two of the hardest moments for me in covering this case. I was pretty terrified on our way to Springfield. I was very nervous. You know, I was shaky. I kept telling Sten how nervous I was. And I had trouble, you know, walking up to the door. Like, I recognized that it was my job and it was something I had to do, but it's not something I was thrilled to be doing, something that I was, you know, very nervous about. And, you know, I had a similar feeling when I looked down at my phone and saw that Tony was calling me. I was definitely not expecting that. And I think you can probably tell if you've been listening to this podcast that I sounded differently on the phone with Tony than I probably do in a normal episode, because I was very nervous. I live alone, so I was home alone. It was 9 o'clock at night. I was relaxing after a long work day. And I was suddenly on the phone with someone who I've been wanting to speak to for over a year, and potentially someone that killed their wife and their children and their dog. And that's not an easy thing to do. Luckily, I have a very supportive co-host in Sten, and he is mostly always willing to take my calls and talk things through with me. And our producer, Peter, is the same.
I'd like to say something to that point. I'm grateful to work in this newsroom. Multiple people reached out to me during this process to ask how we were doing, because we were just writing about violence and surrounded by violence. And these people, whether as reporters or editors, recognize that. And even when I didn't want to acknowledge it or look at it head on, they would ask me how I was doing. And I realized, like, not well. It's not going good. I'm sad.
Yeah, I think there were many days that we walked into the studio and we would look at each other and say, like, how are you? And we'd be like, terrible, or I'm really sad, or I'm really stressed. You know, like, it's not an easy thing to learn about and talk about and analyze murder all day, every day. But the newsroom here, all of our colleagues have been very supportive.
So the last question comes in from Kirsten, who says, I wonder if you can speak to how you've handled questions of reporting ethics throughout this process. I think you've been very sensitive to the difficult issues at hand, and I would love to hear about the discussions happening in your newsroom that have helped to ensure such fair, responsible, and respectful coverage. And before you guys start, I think it's fair to point out that not everybody agrees with Kirsten's assessment of the situation. Like, we've heard some criticisms as well that about the way we've covered this, or whether we should be covering this at all.
This is the question that's basically like why we're doing the Q&A, I feel like. And you asked about what discussions we had about this, about questions of ethics. Peter, if I'm not mistaken, is literally a professor of ethics in journalism. what college, Peter? Kahn?
I've taught an ethics in journalism class at Connecticut College, and I teach at Eastern Connecticut State University, also a different class, but every journalism class that I teach involves some, whether it's the whole class or a portion of the class, it involves some focus on journalistic ethics.
I mean, so we've had a lot of conversations about ethics sometimes, very, very lengthy ones. But one of the first ones we had, and something that still holds true today, is the concern about basically furthering our careers or being proud of, you know, how many listens and downloads we get. Still, sometimes I feel guilty about posting on Twitter or Facebook, or Instagram, even though I've done it so many times, about this project I'd been working on for so long. It's tough to say, here, look at my great work, which involves the deaths of this family. The way that I think I've gotten past it. Maybe it's me rationalizing it, depending on how you look at this, is that any community newspaper, any regional newspaper worth its salt would cover this story. If there's a national story, whether it's crime, human interest, political, that's happening in your backyard, you're going to cover that better than anybody else. That's what's been drilled into us. So we did really try and pay tribute to the family in this and say who they were. That was very important to us, and talk about the communities that were affected. Last thing I'll say that's a more specific example is the funeral. I'll let Taylor talk about what she screwed up, but we both screwed up on covering the funeral. And I think that's where any criticisms that we got were valid, because I came up with this boneheaded idea to ask permission to cover the funeral, even though we were going to be covering it either way, which in retrospect wasn't really an act of goodwill, since we knew we were going to go either way. So it was dumb for me to ask the question. We were told respectfully, asked not to come, and obviously we went because that's our jobs. And thankfully, I think we did we tried the best we could to be empathetic and tell this family's story in a respectful way. And some people, even family members, did recognize that.
Yeah, I think Sten really hit the nail on the head when he said that creating this podcast was kind of just like a minefield of ethical questions. There wasn't a day that went by when we were producing this where we didn't face some sort of ethical question. I would honestly say that an ethics question came up every 5 to 10 minutes while we were recording this. There were times that we spent like 20 minutes on one word choice, on one sentence, phrasing it in the way that was the most fair and balanced and accurate to make sure that we were handling this ethically. And it has not been easy. I think there have been, for all of us, you know, many moments where, I'll speak from my personal experience, there have been many moments where I have thought to myself, like, am I doing the right thing? Is creating this podcast the right thing to do? Is including this interview the right thing to do? Is talking to this person the right thing to do? And I have come back every time I ask myself those questions to our reason for creating this podcast, which is, you know, is something that we defined when we pitched this project. And it's something that we've repeated to all of our sources when we've approached them and said, hey, will you talk to us about this? We're creating this podcast and this is why. And that reason is that we want to lay out all of the facts in this case. We wanted to create one place where people that wanted to know what happened to the Tote family could go and hear everything that is confirmed and everything that is truthful, and could hear it in a fair and balanced way. There are so many, you know, Facebook groups that theorize about this case. There are so many different ideas about what might have happened or what might have gone wrong. And we just wanted there to be a place where people could go for responsible reporting on this. We haven't always gotten it right. We have made mistakes. As Sten mentioned, we received a lot of criticism for our coverage of the funeral. So Sten talked about how, you know, he asked permission to go to the funeral and they asked us not to come and we had to go anyway, which was, you know, our first error. And that wasn't entirely on him. It's a conversation that we had beforehand and we both agreed with. And then once we came back from the services, we kind of divvied up the print story that we wrote about this. And one of the sections that I wrote, I included that the family's remains had not been returned to Connecticut from Florida, which wasn't correct. Their ashes were at the church at the funeral. I relied on information that I'd gotten from officials a day or two before rather than following up with the family that day, because we didn't bother the family at the funeral that day. We didn't approach them with any questions except for to get the name of the man who delivered the eulogy. So we made two mistakes that day, and we apologize to family members for those mistakes. And we hope that, you know, we've kind of healed those errors and that animosity a little bit since then. But I think it goes to show, you know, that we that there are so many ethical dilemmas in the coverage of a case like this, and we're not going to get it right all the time, but we're going to own up to it if we ever do make a mistake or do something that we don't morally agree with after the fact, or if something's brought to our attention that we didn't do correctly, we're not just going to gloss over it. We issued corrections in that story. And like I said, we apologized to the family. And when we were making this podcast, we chose not to use any audio that we recorded from the funeral services, because we did know that they didn't want us there. So we chose not to share that audio with you to respect those wishes.
Because it was a very beautiful eulogy.
It was. But we made a decision that involved a lot of discussion with the higher-ups in our newsroom and between Sten and I. And if I'm not mistaken, that decision was made like the day before we released that episode. It's very last minute, and we chose not to use it. And I think we're both happy with that decision. Thank you to everyone who submitted questions to us. You know, there's a lot of information in this case and about the background of how we reported on it and how we produced this podcast that we hadn't been able to share with you. We appreciate you all taking the time to send those questions in, and we hope to do another one of these down the road. And as always, if you have any questions, you can reach out to us via email or on social media, and we will be back in your podcast feed soon with some other bonus episodes.
Yeah, thank you. I think the interest and the questions were overwhelming. So thank you for sending them in and making us think about things that we hadn't thought about before, or things that we've been thinking about this entire time. And yeah, we're not done. We're not sure exactly how it's going to look, but we are planning some form of coverage of the trial.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to Looking for the Tote Family on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to rate the show. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Looking for the Tote Family is hosted and reported by Taylor Hartz and Sten Spinella. Produced by Peter Huapi and Carlos Virgen. Written by Taylor Hartz, Sten Spinella, and Peter Huapi. Editing by Peter Huapi and music by Carlos Virgen. Tim Cotter is our executive editor. And Izaskun Larnieta is our managing editor. Social media management by interns Josette Moses and Allison O'Donnell. This has been a production of The Day in New London, Connecticut.